The 100 Years' War, to the Giscelin period, Rouen and Paris explode, part two. Now, the king's cavalcade had by now turned back towards Vincennes after all the rioting that took place. The Duke of Burgundy left the main party, accompanied by his chancellor, the Lord of Coussay, and a small group of officials. They rode to Port Saint-Antoine in the eastern end of the city to find out what the heck was happening. A group of Parisians appeared at the gate to speak to them. These men were prominent members of the Paris guilds. They had nothing to say for the rioters and certainly did not speak for them, but they were just hostile to the new taxes. They hoped by mediating between the mob and the government to extract concessions. They made three demands of the Duke: the immediate abolition of all taxes introduced since the beginning of the century, the release of four citizens who had been arrested for organizing resistance to the taxes in February, and an amnesty for the events of the day. Later that morning, the council met at the castle in Vincennes to consider these demands. They decided there would be no compromise. The answer was sent back that the king would concede nothing apart from the release of the four citizens. When this was reported to the leaders of the mob, there was a fresh explosion of violence. The Mallettins headed for the Châtelet, the seat of the royal provost and the symbol of royal power in the city. They broke down the gates, opened up the cells as the sergeants fled for their lives. After this, it was the turn of the city's other prisons, most of which belonged to the bishop and the great abbeys. They were broken open and their prisoners released into the streets. Within the walls of the householders and the guildsmen had already begun to reassert control. Watch was called out, armed, and placed under the control of the guild captains. During night and the following day, they gradually recovered possession of the streets as the violence of the mob burned itself out. But once the municipality had put a stop to the violence, as that shrewd observer Pity noted, they simply took over the rebels' cause as their own. They kept the city gates firmly closed and set about bargaining with the government about taxes. For its part, the Council of Vincennes maintained its defiance. Royal troops were sent to occupy the bridge at Charenton, upstream from the city, and began to stop river traffic carrying in food. The Duke of Burgundy summoned his Burgundian retainers. Rumors got about that Jean de Montfort and even Louis of Anjou were on their way with troops to suppress the resistance of the capital. A show of force suited the authoritarian instincts of Philip of Burgundy, and he may well have contemplated one. But it was no longer realistic. As the news of the rising in Paris spread through the northern provinces, the new taxes were rejected everywhere. At Amiens, where the violent party conflicts of 1358 still lay just below the surface of civic life, men went through the streets shouting out their support for the rioters of Paris. At Dieppe, the town gates were closed in the collectors' faces. At Falaise in Normandy, rioters broke up the auction of the tax farm for the district. At Caen, the collectors were abused and manhandled. Angry crowds took to the streets of Orléans and Reims. Similar scenes were enacted in countless towns in the north. The government was forced to compromise. On March 4, 1382, the council announced temporary suspension of the taxes and a partial amnesty for the rioters. Parisians, for their part, agreed to submit to mediation by the university and deliver up 40 of the ringleaders of March the 1st, who had been arrested by the watch and shut in the Châtelet. They were beheaded or hanged at the gates of the city in small groups over the following days, until the threat of fresh riots made it necessary to suspend executions. The uneasy standoff in Paris enabled the government to make an example of the less formidable antagonists. On March 17, 1382, the king and the Duke of Burgundy left Vincennes for Rouen for a second time. 14 days later, on March 29th, the gates of Rouen were thrown down and symbolically trampled underfoot by the royal party as they rode in with helmets on their heads and drawn swords in their hands. Only 12 ringleaders were executed at Rouen, but the bourgeoisie who had tried to make use of the popular violence was humbled. The municipality was abolished and its powers transferred to the royal bailey. The town bells and coat of arms were confiscated. A vindictive fine of 100,000 francs was imposed, nearly half of which was actually enforced. The authority of the crown had now been upheld, but the issue of taxation remained unresolved. No attempt was made to recall the Estates General, which had shown itself largely ineffective in 1380. Instead, a series of provincial assemblies was summoned in April of 1382, starting with the five bailliages of Champagne and Picardy. Their representatives gathered before the king and his ministers at Compiègne. Paris, the president of the parliament, Arnaud de Courbet, like most 14th century lawyers, profoundly conservative and authoritarian, harangued the delegates about the desperate state of the government's finances. But the most that they would agree to do was consult their constituents. In the event, four of the five billiages refused the grant outright. The fifth, Sens, conceded a sales tax that proved impossible to collect. The reception of the king's demands at Amiens, the only city whose deliberations are recorded, suggests that the problem was not necessarily the principle of taxation, but its distribution amongst the population. The king's need was acknowledged at Amiens. There might have been popular support for a direct tax which would not fall chiefly on the poor, but that was unacceptable to the merchant oligarchies who dominated the civic life of the city. So nothing was agreed to. The Parisians had not been represented at Compiègne, but they were asked to grant their own tax at the rate promised by the province of Sens. The captains of the watch summoned the large assembly to consider this demand. It was rejected by an overwhelming majority. A few voices were raised in support of the government. More would have been if they had not been silenced by the ugly mood of the gathering. At Vincennes, the council refused to take no for an answer. They sent Edouard Cousset to reason with the Parisians. Enguerrard was the popular figure in the capital, one of the few men associated with the court who had been able to circulate freely during the March riots. But even he could only obtain a very slight offer of 12,000 francs. At the end of April 1382, the council resorted in frustration to more abrasive measures. Once again, river traffic serving the city was cut off at the bridge at Charton, this time at the downstream bridge of Saint-Cloud as well. The court moved to Melun, south of the city. From there, troops of Philip of Burgundy began a campaign of harassment against the Parisians, stopping road traffic around the city, wasting the suburban farms and orchards, prominent bourgeoisie. There was even talk of an assault on the walls. There was a long conference in the refectory of the monastery at Saint-Denis, at which the spokesman of the king and the city addressed a panel of mediators as if they were ambassadors of rival nations. The Parisian guild leaders, caught between their fear of the government and their fear of the mob, finally agreed in the middle of May 1382 upon a subsidy of 80,000 francs. But they had no support for this deal, and they knew it. When on June 1, 1382, Charles VI made his formal entry into Paris to mark his reconciliation with the capital, the councillors, who were most closely associated with the crown's attempt to repair its tax system, stayed away for fear that their presence would provoke violence. Normandy, aristocratic, conservative, closely associated by tradition with the monarchy's fortunes, followed the example of Paris with better grace. The Estates of Normandy granted 30,000 francs at an assembly held at Pontoise at the beginning of June. The murmurings of revolt when this decision was first reported at Rouen suggest that it was no more popular amongst urban taxpayers than the Parisian grant. Some weeks later, when the tax began to be collected, a mob of journeymen and servants, led by a butcher, invaded Rouen's cloth market, overturned the stalls, and broke up the market. It's probable, although the evidence is sparse, that similar grants were being made at provincial assemblies across northern France and meeting with similar resentments. By midsummer, tax revenues had begun to flow, but tensions were still high, and proceeds were very disappointing. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3, by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.